One of the words that's been used a lot since the election of Donald Trump is unprecedented. And certainly, some aspects of his win and the transition have been unprecedented. But in some areas, history repeats itself. Joining us with a look at some of the items in the news through the lens of history are two historians who do that every week on the public radio show and podcast Backstory. Ed Ayers and Brian Ballow are with us from Charlottesville, Virginia. Guys, welcome.
Thanks very much. Great
yeah,
to be here.
Yeah, glad to be here.
And one of the big stories that we've been talking about is the rise of fake news, hoaxes, fictional headlines. Some are wondering now to what extent that kind of thing affected the election. But what we do know is that it has really gotten scary in Washington, D.C., where earlier this month, a man from North Carolina entered a pizza shop in D.C. with a gun after reading an online conspiracy about a child sex ring tied to the restaurant and Hillary Clinton. That is not true. But how long has fake news been a problem?
Well, I certainly know it's been a problem since the 1990s, and I'll bet Ed can tell us it's been a problem even longer than that. What really makes fake news, as we call it, is the rapid dissemination and acceleration of that news. Today, that's Facebook, for instance, or social media. Back in the 90s, it was conservative talk radio that took print stories that were often made up of whole cloth, such as Hillary Clinton's aide, Vince Foster, who was found dead in a D.C. park. It's clear that he committed suicide. Yet the story that started going around was that somehow the Clintons had killed him.
Right.
That originated in a small little newspaper. No big deal. I think Ed will tell us that's been around for a long time.
Yep.
What really was different was this new venue, conservative talk radio. People like Rush Limbaugh disseminated that story, and that's why you and I are talking about it today.
Well, and Ed, you say this goes all the way back to the 1890s.
Oh, I'll trump that and say 1790s.
Okay.
You know, really, from the beginning of the nation, people are looking to wrap what they want to say in the guise of a true story. And there's lots of different ways to get there. So Brian's talking about talk radio and the internet, but you also have, hey, what if I had this letter from somebody saying what they really thought, and I'm going to publish it in the newspaper? What could look more authentic than that?
And what could be more rapid dissemination than a stagecoach?
Yeah, of course, now Brian is all electronic and stuff, but that was pretty darn fast in the late 18th century. Well, the 19th century really develops this with great speed. In many ways, the invention of the penny press, the predecessor to these newspapers that Brian are talking about, is based on fake news, and this is a true story. The New York Sun comes up with the idea, just to show how preposterous things people will believe, the fact that the moon is occupied by beings called man-bats who build temples. And it's such a preposterous story, but then it caught on and people wanted to see more and more. So they made up this entire edifice about the people on the moon, which could be viewed with a powerful telescope. And after that was so successful that other people started copying it. So I don't want to take anything away from the Vince Foster story, the 1990s, or talk radio.
Yeah.
But the idea and even the techniques of fake news have been around as long as the country.
But did they affect elections, or is that new?
Yeah, I think they did affect elections. When you have just a really few people, Brian's talking about the stagecoach and relatively small scale of country, you don't have to persuade that many people that a story is true, that somebody is corrupt, that somebody has taken a bribe to sway the entire national election.
The whole purpose of newspapers back in those days was to win elections. Every newspaper, if I'm not wrong, Ed, was aligned with a specific party.
Yes.
And they would absolutely slant the news. Now,
it's not slanting the news, Brian. We're just telling the truth as it appears from the Whig or the Democratic or the Republican's perspective. And if you didn't believe it, you weren't really a man. There's one truth.
No, you might be a man bat, in fact.
Well, a man bat. Well, let's switch gears here, because earlier this week, President-elect Trump raised concerns in the intelligence community when he said he didn't believe the CIA's assessment that Russia intervened in the election. You say examples of foreign influence in elections go back to the election of 1800. What was going on?
So there you have the case is that the French, you know, going through this revolution, this great power, and you've got two very distinct characters. You got this Thomas Jefferson guy who speaks French, digs French wine, and John Adams, who is not into all this. He's much more of the Federalist perspective and kind of veneration of the English heritage and stuff. So the French say, here's the thing. Elect Jefferson, or there may very well just be a real slowdown on the oceans.
And they say it publicly, right?
Oh, well, they publish it in a newspaper. Yeah. Now, how could that happen? Well, they just assumed that the United States was so freaking weak. What are they going to do about it? Right. We're going to come in. It's a very real threat. And the thing is, a lot of people go, yeah, good point. We better do what the French want. And they very nearly distorted all of American politics at the outset.
And in more modern times, have we seen that kind of thing happen?
Well, we'll go back to the Russians, which, of course, they're in the headline today, back as the Soviet Union. The Soviet Union regularly gave instructions to the Communist Party in the United States as to how to vote. They even tried to capitalize on racial tensions in the United States in the late 1960s and early 1970s. One of the tactics they used was to create out of whole cloth pamphlets that they attributed to the Jewish Defense League, a militant group that wanted to defend Jewish rights. And in those pamphlets were horrific characterizations of African Americans. Hmm. And what they were hoping to do was exacerbate already very tense race relations. As you know, we had race riots through much of the latter half of the 1960s. And they were hoping, in essence, to discredit democracy.
All right. Well, we have time for one more thing that I want to talk to you about and look back historically on, and that is the Electoral College. Hillary Clinton, at this point, leads the popular vote count by almost 3 million. That does not change the fact that Donald Trump won, though, in the Electoral College, which is what matters in terms of who becomes president. And now some electors say that they'll flip their vote. A lot of people are talking about just get rid of the Electoral College. Has that ever been tried before?
People talked about it since we've had the Electoral College, frankly. You know, I mean, it's a cobbled together system from the very beginning. Its whole point is to do what it just did, which is to give overrepresentation to less populated states. So the whole idea is that you get the electors relative to the number of senators you have, and of course everybody has that, and to the number of Congress people you have. But here is the thing that was built into it. How would you make sure that the slave states had the share of power they demanded if they were going to join the United States? And of course, it's the three-fifths clause, which is then built into the Electoral College. From the beginning, people could look around and say, it's rigged. This is built so that the slaveholders of the South have a disproportionate share of the power of the country, which they did until the Civil War destroyed it. And it came pretty close in the 20th century, Brian, to
it
being
did.
Discontinued,
in,
right?
In the late 1960s, Richard Nixon had just won a very close election in 1968. And actually, the House voted in a huge majority to get rid of the Electoral College. It was actually very popular at the time. To get rid of it.
Right.
And I will give our listeners three guesses as to where it died. It would be the U.S. Senate. Why would that be? Well, the whole rationale for the U.S. Senate is to give small states disproportionate representation, just like the Electoral College.
So they didn't want to get rid of it in the Senate.
They did not want to get rid of it. Those small states absolutely did not, nor did a lot of the southern states.
I started to say, you're being a little polite.
I am being polite in deference to your southern accent.
That's right. Well, that's okay. The southern states said, look, this has been to our benefit all along. It still is. We don't want these people on the coast telling us what to do. And so that's how you can have the disparity that you just described.
And just to be very clear about why that is, it's because at the time there were still a lot of African Americans who were disenfranchised. So the South got the credit for African Americans being human beings, although they didn't always treat them as such. On the other hand, they knew those African Americans, or they thought those African Americans, weren't going to vote. In fact, they started voting increasingly in the late 1960s.
So they were still reaping the benefit of the three-fifths clause. So, you know, it has been this last election, interestingly, is not about the South versus the rest of the country, the way that so much of American politics has been for the last 150 years. But instead, it's the heavily populated coast against the more lightly populated interior. And so all that's not an accident. It's what the Electoral College is meant to create.
If ever there was a situation where we will not get rid of the Electoral College, it's probably when a president has just won the electoral vote, not the popular vote, and the same party controls the Congress that that president belongs to. I think that's a safe bet.
Probably a safe bet. Ed Ayers and Brian Ballow, co-hosts of the weekly public radio show and podcast Backstory, joining us from Charlottesville, Virginia, to take a look at some of the stories in the news right now and their historical context. Guys, thanks so much.
Thank you, Jeremy.